It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about leaks affecting President Trump's administration, a likely ethics investigation facing Kellyanne Conway, and more in our Week in Washington segment.
First, President Trump's national security advisor resigned on Monday after less than a month on the job. Retired General Michael Flynn stepped down amid claims that he had made phone calls with the Russian ambassador talking about U.S. sanctions on Russia before Donald Trump took office, which could be illegal.
Since Flynn left his position, there are a growing number of questions about national security under the Trump administration, and there's pressure to investigate Russia's role in the U.S., especially after concerns about meddling in the presidential election. Jenna Johnson joins us now. She's a political reporter for The Washington Post. Jenna, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
How is the White House right now dealing with this crisis over the Trump-Russia relationship?
You know what? I was at the White House all Monday and Tuesday, and there was just a lot of rushing around, groups of people meeting behind closed doors. And the messaging that's coming out of the White House doesn't really seem to be consistent. Monday night, when General Flynn resigned, the messaging was that he decided to do this on his own. And then Tuesday, the press secretary comes out and says, no, the president asked him to resign. He was pushed to do this. Now today, Wednesday, the president gets up at a press conference and calls Flynn a wonderful man and basically describes him as a victim of the fake news media.
And now we're hearing reports that aides may have had contact with Russian intelligence during the election, during the campaign.
Well, that's during the campaign, and the White House has said that that's not true, that that was not happening. But there are a series of reports from the New York Times and other news outlets saying that Paul Manafort, who ran Donald Trump's campaign for several months, was examined by the FBI for his connections to Russia, perhaps for talking with intelligence officers there. They're also taking a look, reportedly, at Roger Stone, who didn't formally work for the campaign, but is a longtime friend and advisor to Donald Trump, and Carter Page, an advisor who was advising Trump on foreign affairs and things like that. All of those involved have said that they didn't do anything wrong. They have denied that this is happening. But it just raises a lot of questions about, A, was this in fact happening? And B, did it have any impact on the election results?
Meanwhile, President Trump, he took to Twitter this morning and focused his criticism on both the press and the intelligence community. Is the rest of the administration going on the offensive here as well?
I mean, the president has really been leading the charge on this. His press secretary and others who have spoken with the media have focused more so on Flynn, saying that this was about them not trusting Flynn and, you know, needing to get him out of their circle of trust. But the president has gone very hard after these leakers, saying that this is a crime that has happened, going after the media for reporting on these things. And I think just one important thing to keep in mind with this is that when it comes to General Flynn and this information about him discussing U.S. sanctions with Russia's ambassador before the president took office, which some say could be illegal, the vice president didn't know about this until it was published in the Washington Post. So even within the White House, these reports are surfacing information that even the vice president isn't aware of.
We're talking with Jenna Johnson. She's a political reporter for The Washington Post. And we're discussing the Trump-Russia relationship, the fallout over General Flynn's resignation late Monday night. Jenna, is this leading to a rift between members of Congress and the Trump administration? How is Congress handling this?
Well, Congress is put in a kind of tough spot here because for years, they've been going after Hillary Clinton for her use of sensitive information, criticizing her possible connections to other countries. Now they have a president who has conflicts of his own, and they're being called on by their constituents to treat this president just as they would treat any president. There are also a lot of concerns on the Hill and elsewhere about Russia and about what role Russia may not have played in this election. Investigating that, figuring out what happened or didn't happen, and to take steps to make sure it doesn't happen again. So there's a growing number of people who are calling for an independent investigation into this. Those who seem to have the power to actually make that happen haven't really waded into that yet. So we're just going to have to wait and see. We're also going to have to see what the backlash is. If enough people are calling their members of Congress and pushing on this, they might not have any choice but to do something.
And this independent panel, independent investigation, some Democrats want this independent panel with subpoena power to investigate both Russia's involvement in the presidential election and potential conflicts of interest between the Trump White House and the Kremlin. Would this kind of investigation see the light of day as we look at the makeup of Capitol Hill?
I mean, at this point, as things stand right now, it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
And Russia is a longtime U.S. rival, and Trump's relationship with Putin has always been a subject of suspicion. Is this casting a perhaps darker shadow on his administration? What might happen?
Yeah, it's become more and more difficult for the president to be friendly with Russia. His stance has always been that, you know, he wants to have good relationships with all countries, that he kind of wants to hit the reset button on his relationship with all countries and start anew. And he has said that Russia could be a strong partner for the United States, especially in fighting the Islamic State terrorist group. But with all of these accusations out there, and it seems just like day after day, there's just another story after another story about possible ties between his campaign and Russia, accusations of Russia meddling in the election. It really becomes very difficult for the president to continue to praise Putin and Russia. And we really saw a shift yesterday when Sean Spicer, the press secretary, claimed that the president had been very tough on Russia and that was his position, which seems like a new position.
And could Michael Flynn face any other charges here or be reprimanded beyond losing his job as national security advisor?
Well, it remains to be seen. Again, Donald Trump is the president. There are Republicans on Capitol Hill. So when it comes to anything that they might have any influence over, they're not looking to reprimand him in any other ways. But he has talked with the FBI. And if the FBI were to see any reason to perhaps file charges, then it becomes a more complicated situation. One of the big things he's accused of violating is something called the Logan Act, which forbids citizens from basically working on behalf of the government without authorization. It's a very, very old act. It has never been used, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be used. But again, we're just going to have to wait and see.
And the leaks that President Trump is talking about, the leaks of information to your news organization, The Washington Post and The New York Times, that went to the ability to show that Michael Flynn did have this contact with a Russian diplomat. Are we going to see, do you think, more of this kind of information trickling out of the White House in the form of leaks?
Well, I think that, and again, these leaks are likely coming from a lot of different places, not just from the White House. The government is a very big organization, and it has a lot of government employees who are not political appointees. who care about the work that they do, who probably make less money in the government than they could make elsewhere. They believe in their mission. And if they feel like the White House or the president or members of his cabinet are doing things that are hurtful to the United States, then they're going to blow the whistle on it. There's kind of been this ongoing debate about, are these leakers or are these whistleblowers? As long as there are people who are uncomfortable with what's happening, I think we are going to continue to see information coming out. And in the case of General Flynn, it led to him resigning from his job. So it's not that there's not any merit to what is being released.
Jenna, thanks for your time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That was Jenna Johnson. She's political reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about the fallout after the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a group of Wisconsin lawmakers are working to bring issues facing rural residents to the fore. We find out what their top priorities are.
Right now, Washington, D.C. has been embroiled with controversy over the last week involving advisors to the president. As we just heard, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn resigned after it was revealed he misled the vice president over conversations he had had with a Russian ambassador.
And top Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway has been denounced by ethics groups following her endorsement of Ivanka Trump's company during a live interview.
Craig Gilbert joins us now with the latest on those stories and more. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Well, some breaking news. We're just seeing Andrew Puzder out, apparently, as the nominee, as the labor secretary. Now, this happens in most administrations. There's one or two nominees who don't make it through. From where you're sitting, what sunk this nomination?
Well, it was really kind of a constellation of things. I mean, it just is a kind of an amazing array of controversies and potential problems, ranging from his business history, his history of rhetoric about kind of management and worker relations. Some people were upset about the advertising campaigns he ran for his companies, his personal life, a divorce, and past allegations by his wife about abuse, and financial disclosures. I mean, there was a whole array of things, undocumented immigrant housekeeper. So this nomination kind of gave a wide variety of groups, and not just liberals and not just Democrats, cause for concern. And when you have basically 48 Democrats in the Senate voting en masse in opposition to some of these nominations, the margin for error on the Republican side is very small. It only takes, in theory, three defections to sink a nomination, and we were looking at more than three in this case.
And there were attacks from the right as well, saying he'd been, as a business person and an advocate, too soft on immigration issues. So basically there's something there for everyone to not like in the end.
Exactly. And, you know, there were certainly, like you said, it's not at all uncommon for at least one of a president's kind of initial picks for the cabinet after an election to not make it to the finish line. Overall, the kind of rate of failure for confirmations has been going up over time. We saw that with George W. Bush, Barack Obama. And what's changed, among other things, is that the bar is actually lower now, because the Democrats in 2013 got rid of the filibuster for cabinet confirmation. So it should be easier in practice, and it is mathematically, if you have a majority, to get these picks through. But it also, you know, it can muddy the waters, because a president can feel emboldened because he only needs 50 or 51 votes, and he might nominate somebody like this pick who, knowing that they're more controversial, but thinking, well, I don't need 60 votes, I only need 51, I can get him through. And in some cases, that can lead to a failed nomination like this one.
Or a very razor-thin one where he got 50 votes, which was just enough, given the tiebreaker with the vice president.
Yeah, we had that with
Betsy DeVos.
Secretary. And we've now had, forget about this one because it didn't come to a vote, but we've had, I believe, four nominees who've gotten more than 45 no votes. Or certainly gotten more than 40 no votes. And I think only four during President Obama's 8 years in office attracted that level of opposition. So, you know, there's some special circumstances here. Obviously, things are extremely polarized right now. Democrats are under pressure from their own base to be very forceful in their opposition of President Trump, and President Trump isn't backing down either, and he's sort of pedaled to the floor on some of the things he wants to do. So we're seeing this kind of partisan collision in Washington, which is probably even more pronounced than the ones we've seen in recent years.
Moving on to Michael Flynn, General Flynn resigned as National Security Advisor earlier this week, apparently after being asked to do that by the president. Wanted to talk to you just about some of the reaction, the idea of a wider investigation going on. What have we been hearing from Republicans on that issue in particular?
Well, you're hearing some Republican senators beginning to call kind of up the ante. Only a handful have really sort of talked about being open to an independent investigation, whether it's an independent committee or an independent counsel. Most of them are kind of reluctant to go there still. But, you know, these things have a way of evolving over time. The Democrats are, you know, full speed ahead. New independent inquiry in Congress, independent special counsel in the Justice Department. They want full, independent, nonpartisan, bipartisan investigations. Republicans are very reluctant to go there because no one knows. You know, no one can foresee the end path in something like this. This is really kind of potentially incendiary stuff when you're talking about the combination of a political campaign where you had Russian involvement, and then on top of that, all the national security issues involved with kind of our relationship with Russia and with Russian conduct. So it could be, you know, the Republicans know the potential to do real damage. It's already done some damage, but the potential to do even greater damage to the Trump administration in its infancy is pretty big. But the competing concern is if Republicans start to feel like this is something that is hanging over them that they need to resolve one way or the other, that you could see some additional Republicans calling for more forcefully for new investigations just to try to get the issue resolved and not linger.
Talking about national news with Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, in a recent piece, you looked at Wisconsin's congressional or House delegation, looked at how much latitude members of Congress from Wisconsin might have to break paths with the president. Looking at Republicans in particular, what are they weighing?
Well, so, I mean, the big kind of general factors are going to be President Trump's overall approval rating, which is negative right now, and it's the worst that any recent president has started their presidency with. Secondly, you know, you have to consider the president's approval ratings in his own party, because if we're talking about Republican House members, the constituency they're most responsive to are their own voters, because they don't want to get they don't want to antagonize their own political base. And if President Trump continues to be popular with Republican voters, which he is right now, then it's going to be hard for Republicans in Congress to oppose him, to break with him, to pick fights with him. But beyond that, I think the political factors are going to vary from district to district. I mean, you've got, in Wisconsin, you've got five House members. Sean Duffy in northern Wisconsin, that was the district that where Trump had his biggest winning margin last fall. And so I think, you know, among relative to his colleagues, I think you can expect Sean Duffy to be particularly supportive of Donald Trump, given Trump's popularity in his own district. At the other end of the spectrum, you have Paul Ryan. Trump only won Paul Ryan's district by 10 points. And also, not just that, but Paul Ryan outperformed Donald Trump pretty dramatically. When you look at his congressional vote, he ran way ahead of Donald Trump's presidential vote in his own district. So just in terms of the politics of his home district, he's got more political space if he wants to chart a more independent course for Trump. But, you know, his situation is complicated by the fact that he's Speaker, and he's under a lot of pressure as Speaker to he's invested in the success of the Trump presidency because there's things he wants to get done, and he's been very reluctant to criticize Trump.
Getting back to what's been going on from the White House, the Office of Government Ethics is recommending that the White House take disciplinary action against Donald Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, for these remarks about Ivanka Trump's, Donald Trump's daughter's clothing line. Here's a listen.
They're using the most prominent woman in Donald Trump's, most prominent, she's his daughter, and they're using her, who's been a champion for women empowerment,
sure.
women in the workplace, to get to him.
Just,
so I think people can see through that.
30
go
seconds.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I hate shopping. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
So that's on Fox and Friends, and that's a no-no in government endorsing a company, anybody's company, much less the president's daughter.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like kind of a fairly cut and dry. I mean, I don't know what where this goes in the end and what the consequences ultimately are going to be for her. But it seems, I think, like a fairly cut and dry case of something you're not supposed to do as a public official. I think some of what we've seen, you know, in the early days of the Trump administration maybe can be explained away by people that haven't served in government before. They're also operating in this, you know, really volatile environment where in some cases they're saying things for effect or they're saying things to kind of play to their own base or to the sympathetic media on their side. And so you even heard Republicans react, you know, negatively in this particular case. And it just, you know, it's been part of the kind of soap opera of the early days of the Trump presidency where it's not just all the day-to-day controversies, but it's also kind of all the speculation about, you know, who's in trouble, you know, who's winning the internal power struggles, who's up, who's down, who could be gone in a week or two or a month or two or a year or two. And we've seen the first casualty we talked about in Michael Flynn, but there's been speculation about the press secretary, Sean Spicer. There's been speculation about Ryan Priebus mm-hmm. from Wisconsin, the former RNC chair who's now the White House chief of staff. There are people associated with one faction in the White House and in parts of the conservative media that are really gunning for Priebus.
And we'll leave it there. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
That's Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some of the latest news in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we hear from lawmakers involved with the Rural Wisconsin Initiative about why expanding broadband coverage is a top priority. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, birders of all ages and skill levels will be taking part in the Great Backyard Bird Count this weekend. We'll find out how to join in.
First, members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative held a press conference yesterday to talk about their efforts. Wisconsin lawmakers, whose districts are predominantly rural, are hoping to address issues like education, healthcare, workforce development, and technology in ways that best meet the unique needs of their constituents.
The lawmakers focused on the issue of rural broadband and solutions to reducing the gap between rural and urban customers. Republican Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point and Republican Representative Romaine Quinn of Rice Lake are members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative and join us now to discuss their efforts. Senator Teston, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, great to be on.
And Representative Quinn, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
With nearly a quarter of Wisconsinites living in rural areas, explain each of you how rural issues look different from issues faced by urban areas of Wisconsin or even statewide issues. Senator Teston?
Well, I mean, rural Wisconsin has unique challenges when you take a look at the big picture compared to some of our more urban areas. And some of the challenges that our rural communities face are issues like access to broadband. Unlike some of the more populated areas where they have good internet speeds, if we don't have good broadband, we're putting ourselves at an economic disadvantage, not just when we talk about education, allowing students to have access to high-speed internet, but for things like medical records and also our small businesses, that they have the ability to market their company and their goods to a broader audience.
Representative Quinn, what's unique about issues faced in rural Wisconsin versus elsewhere?
Yeah, if you look, I mean, the biggest part you mentioned right off the bat was that 25% of Wisconsin lives in rural Wisconsin. So right away, we have a people problem, and that problem is getting worse every year. as we send kids off to school, less and less come back. And so it's a two-pronged issue. It's hard to bring jobs and opportunity to an area when the workforce isn't there. And it's hard to keep the workforce there waiting for jobs and opportunities. So we're doing the best we can to address the issues. And again, the Rural Wisconsin Initiative looks at science and technology, healthcare, education. And so those are all important issues where there are unique issues that come in those areas.
Senator Teston, how did the Rural Wisconsin Initiative get started?
Well, this may be a question that's better answered by Representative Quinn, as I'm a freshman, but this was actually an initiative that was launched last session by members of the Assembly who represent rural districts, and they kind of came together with a package of ideas that were going to address some of the issues, or some of the issues that our rural communities face, like Romaine said, workforce development issues, making sure that we have a skilled workforce in the more remote parts of the state, things like access to good health care, access to broadband. Those are all things that are key to making sure that rural Wisconsin can continue to thrive and grow moving forward.
And Representative Quinn, what about the makeup of the lawmakers who are on board with this initiative?
Yeah, and so last session, picking back off of what Senator Teston said, we came together, Representative Ed Brooks and Travis Tranel and myself, recognized that we have issues unique to our districts, recognized that we needed some attention on that. So we tried to bring together a group of people and solve problems that are unique to rural Wisconsin, not Republican, not Democrat, not partisan issues, but real issues where we can make differences on. So right now we have 26 members that are signed up, rural members in the state assembly. And out of 99, that's a good chunk. Anytime you can get 26 lawmakers to sign on to a package of bills and be supportive in United Front is really a big deal. And so that's why we're pretty excited to see some real meaningful change. And we saw now this budget session, the governor has included some of our initiatives into his budget. And so I think that's just building on our momentum, and we're looking forward to this session.
Yesterday's press conference on the Rural Wisconsin Initiative zeroed in on the issue of broadband. Senator Teston, why is that such a concern for rural Wisconsin?
As I said in my opening remarks, it's such a huge concern, an issue for central, not just central and western Wisconsin, but for all of rural Wisconsin, is that if we don't have access to high-speed internet, we're basically put at a disadvantage. I mean, just this past week, I was in the Sparta School District and had the opportunity to meet with school administrators and educators. And although their school has great internet access, many of their students do not. And so some of the challenges that they have, they rent out hotspots for students to use for the weekend so they can do their projects and have access to the internet to get the information that they need. But also, too, when we look at medical records, we are such an interconnected society now, and it's important for people to get, when they're getting their health care needs taken care of, that hospitals are able to communicate with one another and get the records that they need to provide the adequate treatment for the patient. And then for our small businesses, it's hard to attract a business to rural Wisconsin if they know they're not going to have high-speed internet, that they're not able to market and communicate their company and their goods to others outside the area.
We're talking today with Senator Patrick Teston and Representative Romaine Quinn. They're members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative. It held a press conference yesterday to highlight work on issues in rural Wisconsin. Representative Quinn, how does federal funding for broadband fit into the picture of increasing access in Wisconsin?
Yeah, no, and the federal government has played an important role in this. They have given the state of Wisconsin over $500 million to invest towards broadband and building that infrastructure out to those underserved areas. But what we have done is taken our program that was developed by Governor Walker when he first came in, and we've put in better and new parameters to better define underserved area and to really put in stipulations that ensure that the money that we're spending, your taxpayer dollars, are going only exactly where it needs to go, so that there's no overbuild, so we're not spending on projects that already exist or areas that already might have service. And then we're putting in new areas where the Public Service Commission can look in and take into account when awarding a project. So, as Senator Teston said, economic development, but we also put in place The potential needs of residents in terms of their education and health care as well. So it is great, the amount of money that we have coming in. Problem is, I don't think the federal government does quite as good of a job at ensuring certain stipulations and who gets that and the kind of service they will be delivering, which just goes to my whole federal argument that, gosh, we could have done some amazing things if the federal government would have said, hey, state of Wisconsin, here's $500 million and use your great program that you already have existing and build out how you think Wisconsin needs it. But either way, we're very grateful, and it's a huge investment going on even in my district, and it's going to be connecting a lot of people that have been out in those dead zones in our state.
But how different would the situation be in rural Wisconsin if Governor Walker had chosen to accept federal stimulus funding for broadband in 2011?
Sure. And again, I wasn't in the legislature during that time, and we've had this debate last session. And we sat down with providers, and we've been working with them, the telecoms and so on, since I've been in office. And we asked them, why on earth would Governor Walker turn down the $23 million? And they basically said, due to the nature of our already existing program, BadgerNet, and the program that the Governor Walker had developed, there was really no way that our program could have taken those federal dollars. So it's easy for a news story to say, wow, how are you turning down federal stimulus money? But even our provider said, we love the money. We always want more money. But we even understood that at that time, we just could not have accepted it because of the stipulations that came with it. So we're happy to see the federal government coming back with their own investment. And we're happy to see the governor freeing up money for investment for our program as well.
And Senator Tustin, might there be some pushback from other high-need areas and populations for this type of funding?
Well, it's hard to say, but that's why it's important that we have a united front on this, having the 26 members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative in the Assembly, but then the Senate partners, including myself, Senators Tiffany, Senators Terry Moulton, and Senator Jerry Petruski, that we can make a strong case that these are underserved areas that absolutely need this. And so when we talk to our colleagues from more populated areas of the state, we can show them that there is a real need for these programs to be allocated in rural Wisconsin.
Representative Quinn, the trend has been for rural populations, as you said, to decrease with residents move to more urban areas. You mentioned Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Chicago. Do you think that the efforts of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative could help keep people in rural communities?
Oh, absolutely. And see, the thing is, we don't come up with these ideas out of thin air, or they're just our own ideas. We sit down with stakeholders in these rural communities and say, what issues are you finding? And why can't you attract advanced clinicians to your hospitals and your clinics? Why can't you find skilled workers? And here it's we're hearing all these issues, and we sat down with these stakeholders to identify. So our bills are very specific in nature to address real specific problems. And so they are absolutely going to make a difference. So, for instance, we talk broadband. Does that not only play in economic development, a person's education, or healthcare, it's also about attracting new people. Are you going to move to Rice Lake, Wisconsin, if you're 5 miles out of town and you can't have internet access in your home? Absolutely not. So it's a quality of life issue as well. So it's not that it's easy for us to always fight for things and money for our own district. But if Wisconsin is going to succeed as a whole, its rural areas have to keep up as well. And these investments really, in terms of the overall budget, what we spend, are very insignificant in terms of dollars. But they're very pointed and they're very important, as we've talked through with our stakeholders. So we're getting the best bang for our buck, and they're going to make real differences.
Senator Tustin, there are a lot of competing issues, a lot of competing interests in a budget year. How will you work to get broad support for the initiative's efforts in the legislature and in the governor's office?
Well, I think it starts by building relationships with our respective colleagues in each of our chambers. And that's what my approach has been, coming from a sales background. You're not going to be very successful if you don't build relationships with the people you work with. And so I intend to make a concerted effort over the course of these next few months to work with my colleagues to find solutions to address some of the problems that we face, not just in rural Wisconsin, but across the state. And then in the hopes of enacting good policy, that's going to be for the betterment of everyone. Because regardless if you're a Republican or Democrat, we all want what's best for our families, for our communities, for our state and our country. We just may have different ways of getting there. So we need to focus on the common ground first and build off of that and hopefully have some successes in this budget cycle.
Senator Tustin, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
And Representative Quinn, thanks for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me.
State Senator Patrick Tustin and Representative Romaine Quinn are members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative, which held a press conference Tuesday to highlight work on broadband issues.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we talk with the lawyer who is representing a Syrian refugee living in Wisconsin who is challenging President Trump's travel and refugee ban.
First, this weekend marks the 20th annual Great Backyard Bird Count. The information collected helps the National Audubon Society and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology assess how bird populations are doing and what changes to their habitats might mean for long-term survival and success. Last year, over 160,000 birders of all ages and skill levels participated and then submitted their observations online.
Ryan Brady is a research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Why do a bird count at this time of year here in February?
Well, we don't have as many birds as we have at other times of year, but we still have some birds that we want to keep track of, understand how many are out there, how they're distributed across the landscape, and how those numbers might be changing both year to year and over longer periods of time. Like you said in the intro, this is the 20th year of the survey, so we can get a good picture on how those populations might be trending. So it's a good opportunity to maybe beat the doldrums of winter and get a snapshot over this four-day period of what those bird populations are doing at a time when, frankly, we don't have a lot of other really great data on the bird populations from the mid to late winter period.
What kind of things have we learned from this in years past?
Well, in years past, you can see how certain birds might be trending in a certain direction. For example, some might be moving northward as we've had some of these warmer winters in recent years, and also due to bird feeders becoming more dominant at the northern edge of some of the birds' range. So a good example of this is the northern cardinal. Cardinals' populations have been drifting northward, particularly through Wisconsin, now can be found all the way up on the Lake Superior. You also see year-to-year changes in food availability. So there's certain birds that only really move if the foods that they eat are not available in that given year. And so if there's a particular seed crop like spruce or fir that isn't produced in a given year, a bird like a red-breasted nuthatch or a crossbill or an evening grosbeak might have to move farther away to go find additional foods. And so we can see these sorts of trends and movements by taking these snapshots through such a powerful and robust citizen science program like the Great Backyard Bird Count.
Yeah, a lot of people participating in this. And so what do groups like the National Audubon Society and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, what did they use this data for once all of this data is submitted?
Well, some of the things that we've touched on are, you know, really about tracking the migration patterns for a lot of these birds, maybe understanding how they're shifting in terms of their movements, maybe how things like disease, West Nile virus, or in some cases in some parts of the world, even avian influenza might be affecting the way birds are responding to those environmental changes, how they shift and so forth. So there's a lot of different utilities, especially, like I said, when you build that data set up over a long period of time. That gives you a lot of power to see what might just be a blip on the radar versus something that's an actual trend.
I want to ask how people can sign up and get involved with this, Ryan. Let's narrow this down a little. Even if it's somebody like me who can identify a bird as, you know, being something other than a tree, you know, I know it's a bird. I have a hard time telling one kind of bird from another. Can even people such as me help out, and if so, how?
Yeah, the beauty of the Great Backyard Bird Count is its simplicity. You can do it anywhere, anytime during that four-day period, and you don't have to know all the birds you see. You just have to know, frankly, you just need to know one. But most people know a handful of the more common ones and so forth. And you just have to spend at least 15 minutes. That's all I ask is you spend at least 15 minutes at that location tallying what birds you saw and how many of them. And if you can't get an actual count, then an estimate works too. And then you go and enter them online. And it's even broadened. The name suggests the Great Backyard Bird Count. And that's how it started, was the idea of looking at your backyard feeders and kind of harnessing all those observations that folks are making, because so many people love watching birds. But it's really expanded. It's not just your backyard. You can do it when you're on the road. You can do it at a local park. You could do it at a national wildlife refuge. Wherever you are, you can do it.
We're talking with Ryan Brady. He's a research scientist for Wisconsin DNR and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. We're talking about the Great Backyard Bird Count. So, Ryan, what types of bird species might we see during this count?
Well, a lot of folks do it from their backyard, so a lot of those backyard bird species are ones that are commonly reported. And so if you look at the top 10 number of birds on the scale of North America, not just Wisconsin, we're talking about dark-eyed juncos, northern cardinals, mourning doves, downy woodpeckers, blue jays, goldfinches, black-capped chickadees, American crows. So those things you're used to seeing out your window, they're fairly common on the landscape, and a lot of folks can identify them. But then farther afield, you can see all kinds of interesting birds, snowy owls, golden eagles, maybe some sort of rare gull like the one seen in Milwaukee recently, the slaty-backed gull. So there's a whole variety of species you can find, maybe anywhere from 125 to 150 species get reported in Wisconsin during the course of this four-day period. And some of them are going to be readily seen in your backyard, and others you're going to have to go out and maybe dig around, and that's half the fun of birding.
You mentioned a kind of chickadee. We have a little audio of that. Here's a listen. Oh, see, even I know that's a chickadee. Okay, I feel better about myself now. Now, speaking of sound, do we have to actually, Ryan, lay eyes on the bird, or if we hear the bird, can we count it as part of our backyard bird count?
Even if you hear it, if you can readily identify it with certainty, then in the birding and bird monitoring world, that counts as a detection, and so you could enter that. And so a chickadees right now, a lot of them are doing their calls, the chickadee-dee-dee, but some of them are starting to sing that two-note CD song that you played there. And that's kind of a sign of the season, where the day length is getting longer. That's triggering that bird to think about breeding and nesting season. And they're starting to advertise their territories and to prospective mates. And so they're starting to sing that song. So that's in a lot of birders' worlds, the chickadee switching over to that song is a pleasant sign of spring to come.
Mm. And speaking of spring to come, it seems kind of interesting that creatures as delicate as small birds can survive a Wisconsin winter. How do they cope with cold temperatures and then the storms and less access to food and water?
Well, some of them have certain behavioral modifications, like they might roost in cavities. So bluebirds might spend their time in the winter in southern Wisconsin, not many of them, but some of them roosting in cavities in groups together, kind of all huddled up. Many species will roost in conifer or evergreen trees, where it provides a little warmer temperature. It's a little bit of a buffer. Some of them undergo more physiological changes, literally. Chickadees will lower their body temperature during the wintertime at night to be able to cope. Some of them will eat more to make up for that demand. So there's a variety of adaptations that some birds have figured out that allow them to stick around and enjoy our winters.
And Ryan, I've got to ask, last time I think you were on the show, you introduced me to the bird, the parasitic jaeger, which gets its food by knocking food out of other birds' beaks, as I understand. I've been fascinated with the parasitic jaeger. Is this too soon to start seeing them? And if so, when can we expect them back in northern Wisconsin?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say you're not going to find one on the Great Backyard Bird Count, Rob. You're going to have to wait until May, because it's May when those birds start moving north again. That's a bird that nests in the Arctic tundra, and so it is spending its winters out in the oceans, chasing birds and making them regurgitate out there, and then it's going to move back north come May and nest up in the Arctic, and then we'll have a chance to see it again on its way south again in September.
All right, I still want to advance the hashtag parasitic Jaeger. Ryan, thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Brady, research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR, bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Institute. He joined us to talk about the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is going on this weekend. You can get information on how you can participate over on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate, are you pretty good at spotting, distinguishing birds from one another?
I can spot, perhaps not too readily distinguished.
I know some, like a crow. I know a crow.
I know
red-tailed
a crow.
Hawk,
yeah.
Robin, cardinal.
It's a start.
The basics. Can do. The finer points I have trouble with. Well, again, whether you're good at this or not, find more information on the bird count. You can get that on the Central Time Facebook page. You've heard the saying, you're never too old to follow a dream. It could even hold true for dogs, it turns out. A German Shepherd from Wisconsin came out of retirement to win Best in Show at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show last night at Madison Square Garden in New York.
5-year-old Rumor from Edgerton had reportedly been enjoying retirement on the couch, thinking about having a litter of pups, when she took one more shot at being crowned America's top dog. She was edged out last year by a German short-haired pointer.
5 years, that's not that old in the scope of things. Maybe in people years, that's retirement age. I don't think that's even
no,
right.
Not even.
So her handler says Rumor is named for the hit song Rumor Has It by Adele, who also won some awards this week, sweeping all the major categories over at the Grammys.
So here's the deal. After her press tour around New York and her photo opportunities, the German Shepherd will be headed back to Wisconsin to be a family pet again. And pups really are in her future, Rumor has it.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
She ain't got your love anymore.
Rumor has it.